Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
What I think is amazing about him is this prodigious originality. If Childe Harold's Pilgrimage is not the greatest long poem in English of the Romantic period, then Don Juan certainly is. Given that Wordsworth's The Prelude was not published and unheard of or unknown until 1850, these are the two great long poems of the English Romantic era, enormously influential. His friends were told him, of course, not to publish Don Juan, not to continue with it. That only made him continue with it more eagerly. I would want to say, and one of the things I keep pondering hours thinking to myself is what I ought to do is write a book on Byron's poetic masterpieces, because there are so many of them. It is not just Childe Harold and Don Juan, of which people may have heard. There are so many other great poems, The Giaour, The Prisoner of Chillon, Beppo, Mazeppa, some fascinating neoclassical plays. The originality really is prodigious, and I think these are marks that Byron mostly is setting for himself, and it's lucky in a way that he was in Italy, in a foreign culture, where he could set his own marks and decide himself what he wanted to do and where he wanted to take his talent.
I have no consistency except in politics, and that possibly arises from my indifference on the subject altogether. The curious words of British Romantic poet Lord Byron, taken from Richard Lansdowne's latest publication, Byron's Letters and Journals, published by Oxford University Press. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. What makes a poet? And did Lord Byron define what it meant to be one? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack those questions with one of the world's leading experts on Lord Byron, Richard Lansdowne, whose latest publication, Byron's Letters and Journals, has just been published by Oxford University Press, where Richard argues, the letters give the truest portrait of the man. They possess at their best in their ease, freshness and racy vigour a very high literary value. Richard goes on to state, like all correspondents, Byron orientated himself to whoever he was addressing, his mother, wife, half-sister, or latest mistress, his publisher, or the unfortunate Spoonie Hansen, or his intimate friends. The journals, however, are written for himself and give us a peculiarly intimate sense of revelation. So, what type of a poet, man and lover was Lord Byron? And how did a shy boy from Aberdeen become mad, bad and dangerous to know?
Hi, everybody. And thank you, Sue, so much for having me on the show. My name's Richard Lansdowne. I'm a professor of modern English literature and culture at the University of Groningen in northern Holland, where I've been just for 6 months or so. For 20 years before that, I worked in Australia and have been working on Lord Byron, but the romantic poets and writers generally, but Lord Byron above all, ever since I was a postgraduate at University College London in the early 1990s. So, I've been involved with Byron's work for a long, long time, and it's wonderful to have been able to produce this edition of his letters, which I think are some of the best in the language.
Richard, what an interesting collection of letters you've brought out from Lord Byron. I have to say they're very provocative. Some of them are very funny, very racy, full of energy, full of vibrancy, and there's so much to play with. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure, we can take it from there. Do you think great poetry excuses bad behaviour?
That is a monumental question to start with, Sue. It's probably fair to say that whatever we're going to say about Byron's letters in the remainder of our discussion, well, it might shed some light on it. If you want a rapid answer right from the get-go, I would probably say no. You know, we have some poets who have behaved very badly to people around them. It's also true, however, of course, that with the passage of time, a lot of that bad behavior kind of disappears. You know, Dante was not a particularly nice guy, but it's many, many hundreds of years ago. Ezra Pound was a fascist and an anti-Semite and a traitor. It's just much more recent, and so we remember the bad things alongside the good things in people's work. Do you follow me? Over time, you know, the bad does, I'm glad to say, tend to sink away. But no, I don't think you should ever justify bad behaviour because you have talent. No.
So when I say Byron or maybe the Byronic hero, what jumps into mind for you? What do you think of?
Yeah, that's another super question. I what does one ever think about anybody, you know, Cousin Tom or something, when you think about them? It, yet on the other hand, it's true that unlike someone like Shakespeare, in the case of Byron, we have so many images of him. We have images in paint, graphic images. We have accounts in prose and so on and so forth. So we have a much richer harvest of kind of images of him than we have of poets before his era. And because he was so famous in his time, of course, he was repeatedly captured and his image was reprocessed again and again and again. So you can, it is true, you can get a mental image. And I think anyone who likes Byron will probably have a slightly different one. For me, I don't know, what do I think of? A boyish figure? Dressed in a rather dandily way, with a moderate limp, on a terrace above the Mediterranean, maybe pondering the Colosseum, getting out of a gondola. For me, it's always, I always think of him, I must say, in Italy rather than England. And if it's any help, there are many, many portraits of him. Of course, one of them graces the cover of the book. None of the formal portraits, to my mind, really capture him. The best two that I know are by people informally. There's a lovely one, a silhouette, a drawing cut out of card by Lee Hunt's wife, whose name I now forget, in Genoa in 1822 or something, of Byron in a riding costume with a riding whip and a riding hat on. And another lovely one of around about the same time by Count d'Orsay, of a man with rather thinning hair and a pair of plaid trousers, if I remember. Those two informal images capture much more of him, I think, than the stage-managed portraits that are much more famous, much more commonly reproduced.
He clearly was a very magnetic character. I'm just wondering, though, Richard, how much of a free thinker was he? Like, he liked to present himself, it seems, as a bit of an outsider. But it's not that clear-cut, was he one or not?
Yeah, impulsive. Certainly, but what one often wants to think about him is his example makes us want to think a little bit about what impulsiveness really amounts to. Many of his most apparently impulsive decisions actually perhaps come from much deeper seated impulses, if you know what I mean. His grand tour, his escape to the Mediterranean in 1811 or something, or his marriage, or his final trip to Greece. Sometimes these will look to us like decisions taken on the turn of a dime or something like that, the toss of a coin, but they come from something, I think, always much, much deeper in him. To what extent that's true of everybody, I don't know, but certainly it's true of him. So impulsiveness and something more deep-seated, always intertwined, I think.
Certainly, a lot of the letters show his great appetite for life. They also show a very self-critical side and the fact that he went in for a lot of deep self-analysis, and certainly how he analysed his relationship with his mother.
Yeah, yeah. Is this as much of a paradox as perhaps it appears? An appetite for life does often accompany, I think, a sense of self-analysis or a habit of self-analysis in his case. I don't think he could respond to the world about him in the way that he obviously did, and in his letters most peculiarly powerfully, I think, without also realizing that his vision was part of that world, that he was part of it, what's his role in these things, what is his role in responding to the world, what is the nature of his own consciousness. I think we might return to his mother, who's a crucial figure, and yet he does indeed recognise the importance of her role in his background. I've no doubt about that.
You have collated, I think it's about 300 letters in Byron's letters and journals. They're also varied and very emotional and have a lot of force to them. But presumably you were faced with obviously getting rid of some, and, you know, as you edited down and whittled down your list. So what was that like? Because every letter that you you don't present to the reader gives another flavour or another feel for the man.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a Many people who've reviewed the book very kindly have commented on what a vile job it must have been to have to cut ones out. And one or two reviewers have nicely pointed out to me, you know, for the ones that I certainly should have kept in. You get that kind of awful moment to go, oh, no, of course you're quite right. He wrote a letter, but just before he went to Greece, jumped on a boat to go, what should happen? Literally, I think, in a day or two before he departed from Italy, he got a letter from Goethe, of all people, and was, as you might expect, this is the great, you know, paterfamilias of German letters, he was awestruck and gratified, and wrote to Goethe in a kind of hasty lines before he went away. And certainly, in retrospect, I should have kept that one in. You're just trying to get, I suppose, as many, as you say, as many of the moods that you can possibly capture. Certainly, I think all readers of Byron's letters know that there are ones you just couldn't get rid of, you know what I mean? But you're just trying to get as many moods as you possibly can of what was such a multifaceted individual.
But within those moods, Richard, you're reading them as Richard. Somebody else will read them as Tom or John or whatever, bringing their own history and emotion and psychology into it, and will, I suppose, read into different things in different ways and see the layers somewhat differently. So did you find that somewhat constraining in any way, or did you have to consult lots of different people, or how did you go about it?
Well, I think what did I end up saying somewhere in the introduction somewhere, that the value of these letters lie? That, you know, what do they tell us about Byron's own time? They are historical documents. What do they tell us also about his creativity? They are sort of literary critical documents. They tell us something about his work as a poet and so on and so forth, as a creative person. Yet they are also creative objects in their own right. They are aesthetic objects in their own right, much as poems are. So that was always my kind of touchstone. I can't jump outside my own skin as an editor. I've spent many years of my life in company with Byron, yet on the other hand, I try always not to be proprietorial about him if I can possibly avoid it. Maybe I didn't, I don't know, but always wanted to try and keep a certain kind of distance, so precisely that other readers could see him without my overshadowing the experience too much. But always I was trying to think of those three particular elements, you know, that what light do these documents shed on his time, what light do they shed on his creativity, and just as importantly, what light do they demonstrate in themselves?
Just wondering, Richard, do you think it's fair to judge a person, anyone, be it a poet, a politician, whoever they are, by their letters? Because they're not exactly, they don't offer a complete picture of a person, and they don't necessarily always provide us with the truth. So I'm just wondering, like, whether it's an email, a letter, or a quick note somebody leaves, you know, they know, it's not necessarily the exact story at any given time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yet, on the other hand, have we got anything better? I think in your series of broadcasts, you've returned to people's letters repeatedly, and we do. We love them. They continue to be published. They continue to have a peculiar magnetic appeal to readers. And they have done, actually, I might add, it more or less ever since Byron's time, the publication of Byron's letters is not, I think, by any means the first case of a writer's personal documents being published in this way, but it's certainly a very important case. And thereafter, the matter of publishing people's letters becomes much more significant in publishing history. They can never be, obviously, a complete picture. Biographies are, of course, much more historical. They give us chains and sequences of cause and effect and so on and so forth. But it's also true that letters uniquely give us something of the variety of their authors. I'm at the moment talking of great letter writers. I'm reading Vincent van Gogh's letters.
Oh, yeah.
And what one can't help noting there, fascinating though those letters are, is that 90% of them are written to one man, and that one man is his brother Theo. And so that dominates the collection, and we don't get anything like the same remarkable breadth of correspondence and that we do in the case of Byron. And wonderful those Vincent's letters are, they are comparatively a confined affair. It's the matter of writing to different people in different voices that makes collections of letters of this kind so unique.
But you see patternings, I suppose, and they give you certain types of insights into how a letter writer wants to present themselves to different people, or as you say, the different voices that they echo through in their letters, don't they?
Well, yes, absolutely, definitely. You could get some of Byron's letters. Well, you could do it all over the place. You could take the addressee off the top. And I could probably, and other readers of Byron's letters could probably do just the same trick and say, I'm sure that one's to Augusta, I'm sure that one's to Theresa, I'm sure that's to Lady Byron, I'm sure that's to Thomas More. He drops into, as we do with all our friends, I'll take it, drop into and relations to. He drops into certain idioms. And then, of course, wonderfully, you get unprecedented letters. There are some of them in here, you know, where he writes to somebody else. And the voice changes all over again. That is part of it. And I try to capture and keep a few of those outside the major streams of correspondence. Some letters to people, unprecedented letters, unrepeated ones, where again, you just hear a different voice again.
The letters to Lady Melbourne are absolutely incredible. She was a very pragmatic, switched-on lady. She was his confidant, and she also introduced him to a lot of his flings, so to speak. She networked with quite a lot of high-ranking women who seemed to find Lord Byron particularly attractive. I might get you to read out one or two of the letters, because they show great psychological depth on behalf of Lord Byron, but also how he was well able to play people.
Here, for example, lovely one to Lady Melbourne, it seems to me, from 25th of September 1812. Lady Melbourne, as you say, was so well connected that she was well connected both to Byron's famous mistress, Lady Caroline Lamb, and to his future wife. So she has a unique and awkward role to play. My dear Lady Melbourne, it would answer no purpose to write a syllable on any subject whatever, and neither accelerate nor retard what we wish to prevent. She must be left to chance. Conjugal affection and the Kilkenny theatricals are equally in your favour. You see, Lady Caroline Lamb, I think, has been dragged off to Ireland by her family to try and break up their affair. For my part, it is an accursed business towards nor from which I shall not move a single step. If she throws herself upon me, if not, the sooner it's over, the better. From this moment, I have done with it. Only before she returns, allow me to know that I may act accordingly. But there will be nothing to fear before that time, as if a woman, and selfish woman also, would not fill up the vacancy with the first comer. You know what I mean? So he assumes that Lady Caroline left to her own devices, and certainly in being separated from him, will quickly find a substitute, you follow me?
On that point, how would you describe, Richard, his attitude to women? Like, clearly he'd a great intellectual relationship with Lady Melbourne, and they both found each other very stimulating company. It seems through the letters that they kind of really got off on each other in this kind of weird way. Yeah. But in his general dealings with women, it seems that he just went through women, was very capable of discarding them when the next best came along, and didn't seem to look back ever. You know, he didn't seem to be a man plagued by regret or remorse in any way, that he just pressed on.
Yeah. I think that is true, and to some extent, and it is very sad to note that this epistolary relationship with a person he called his aunt, Lady Melbourne, simply evaporated once he left England in 1816. He never wrote to her again and noticed her death with sadness a few years later. His relationship to women are very paradoxical. We get all sorts of things here. There are cases that maybe we'll discuss in a minute, including Claire Claremont. There are cases that are deeply regrettable, then we have cases of profound dependency. There is a we have a letter to a chambermaid at Newstead Abbey who had the temerity to jilt him. You follow me? To here he is, the lord of the manor, and she, a modest, a humble chambermaid, and she elects to go off with another man, and he is very far from being able to take a kind of aristocratic and lordly attitude. He's devastated. So, we have all sorts of attitudes from him in these letters here. His attitude to his half-sister is tragic and woefully bleak. His attitude to Teresa Guiccioli, his longtime mistress in Italy, is full of love and affection. It is true, he doesn't look back a lot, and in the years in Venice, he seems to have seen himself as a playboy and a stud to some extent, though I think he saw that that too was something of a pose and a ruse, and was glad to get out of it in the end, and felt that Teresa had rescued him from that sort of lifestyle. Certainly women are a major theme here, and there are many, many different attitudes to them registered.
But there seems to be absolutely no sentimentality on any level once they have, passed their requirements. Do you know what I mean? Surplus to requirements, so to speak. Because it's hard to, reconcile some of his antics, sexual antics, with the beautiful words and some of his most exquisite poetry. And to see that the same man would be so harsh and cruel to so many women.
I guess both of those things register truths about him. The correspondence with Teresa Guiccioli is perhaps the most profound here. There is an immense dependency. There is no question about that. He really becomes almost suicidal with anxiety about her on certain cases. Decides that he ought to leave the country altogether to rescue her reputation and so forth. And then in the early 1820s, we see a calmly kind of domesticated matrimonial set of relationships there that are those of a sort of middle-aged married couple. There is transition all the time. I agree with you. There is a good deal of pain. There is a good deal of rejection. There is a good deal of a fair amount of cruelty, but it's also true a fair amount of dependency too.
It struck me as I was progressing through the letters that, what would we have done with Lord Byron today on social media? Because, what he was willing to say at any given time, or what he was willing to put pen to paper to. There's a great letter he has to the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. And he writes, "I trust you do not permit yourself to be depressed by the temporary partiality of what is called the public for such favourites of the moment." And he goes on about how and why they should be compared or not. And it's a very revealing letter, and it shows his contempt almost to critics and to what's perceived to be, standards and doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly interesting. But if you could, picture that man today and dealing with the ravages and harsh environment of social media, he would have been crucified, literally.
Yes, no doubt. It's important to remember that, we've already spoken about the variousness of his letter writing. He writes to people in such different ways. In letters to Coleridge, it's fellow poet to fellow poet. And that, to some extent, is one of the poses. Do we not all, to some extent, pose in the different letters that we write? That is one of the poses that he adopts, that of aristocratic indifference to criticism. That is what he's writing to one of the most oversensitive, one might say, poets in the English language here, trying to cultivate in him, I guess, a degree of impunity to what critics say. That response is one I can well imagine him taking to the social media world of our own, and the sort of gotcha moments and our apparently bottomless taste and desire to go through the litter bins of people and find out how they really are. This is one of his responses, to cultivate a sort of aristocratic disregard. But we know from elsewhere that he was sometimes, you know, morbidly hurt by what people said. He, God knows, he had some terrible things to say about John Keats, but was very sad to hear what he was told was the truth, that Keats had been rendered almost suicidal or deeply sick by a poor review of one of his poems. So, yeah, you know, just trying to cultivate a thick skin to media commentary would be one of the things that he did, one of the things we all do, I suppose.
Richard, do you think Byron was conscious that, or was aware that, you know, his letters would be read and passed on, and there would be somebody like you today publishing collections of his letters? Like, he knew as he was penning these different letters with different degrees of force in them, that this was going to happen?
Yes, I think that is almost uniformly recognised to be the truth among people who take an interest in him, especially after, you see, he became, as in his own famous expression, he became famous overnight, and must have well realised that certainly letters to, above all, I suppose, his masculine circle of friends, his publisher John Murray above all, it becomes absolutely apparent that he knows these are going to get circulated. His publisher had a sort of regular afternoon tea parties where his favourite authors would pop round for a chat, you follow me, in a cup of tea, and Byron would have been well aware of the nature of these. He'd met Walter Scott at one of these parties, you follow me, so he would have been well aware that a letter from him would get read out, would get carefully put away by John Murray, who worshipped him. And I think he would have been well aware that other people were storing such documents up in very similar fashion.
How do you understand the relationship Byron had with his stepsister, Augusta Leigh? They had the same father but a different mother. And I know the mother was very made a conscious decision after Byron's father pretty much packed his bags when Byron was quite young and he fled the house, that to keep them apart, because she was conscious of that they could possibly have some type of unusual relationship. They had a daughter together, which is a very uncomfortable fact. So I'm just wondering, how do you deal with all of that?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say that the evidence is still out on whether Medora Leigh was fathered by Lord Byron. I haven't watched any recent scholarship here. It's been an object of speculation for you know, generations. I don't think we'll ever be able to prove it one way or the other. Byron makes a passing remark in one of his letters about, thank goodness the child is not an ape, which could be some sort of comment on incestuous birth or something. I really don't think we have any evidence one way or the other, finally, on that matter. The relationship with Augusta, however, is incredibly important. I think after the relationship with his mother is vitally profound. The relationship with his father is no less profound for the fact that his father wasn't there. An absent father is a present in his own way. After his father's and his mother's death, Augusta really is, as it were, the last person he's got left. He wants from her what I guess we all want from family members. Blood is thicker than water, after all. He wants what we all want from somebody, unconditional affection. And that, I think, to some extent, he got from her. Moreover, it's apparent they had so much in common, above all, I think, a sense of humour, which Byron really seems to have valued in people. We might talk about Thomas More later, but it's certainly what he valued most in Thomas More. They had this thing of having something instinctively in common is terribly important in his relations with her. And so he found that when she withdrew from him in the aftermath of the scandalous separation with his wife, he was tremendously hurt. But this is a very profoundly family-oriented person who loses members of his family one after another. I think the relationship with the father is an immensely important psychological clue to Byron's case. His repeated pattern of taking up younger boys to look after them at school and elsewhere does seem to me his desire to demonstrate, in part, paternal affection, the very thing that he himself did not receive. So there are absent family figures who are nonetheless important for that reason. I think modern psychology could tell us a great deal more about these things.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're unpacking the life and legend of British Romantic poet Lord Byron with scholar, writer and teacher Dr. Richard Lansdowne, whose latest publication, Byron's Letters and Journals, has just been published by Oxford University Press. I asked Richard about Byron's close correspondence and friendship with his business agent and solicitor, John Hanson, a man Byron felt truly accountable and responsible to. And I put it to Richard whether it could be argued that Hanson was somewhat of a father figure to Byron.
Like so many of Byron's relationships, somewhat paradoxical. We look at Hanson, I have to say, and wonder, you know, could you not have chosen another lawyer? The person's business practices were just woeful, and the number of times he let Byron's very important business interests lapse for weeks and months on end when Byron's own finances and legal situation were complex and required the attention of a very careful solicitor. It's so touching, the loyalty Byron had to this person. I think most of us would be advising him, in the name of God, get the yellow pages out and find yourself something much better qualified, much more capable. Yet precisely because Byron was introduced to him almost as a child, it's touching. He just feels he can't possibly go anywhere else. It is remarkable. It's another surrogate family. He had a few of those, and the Hansons are certainly a kind of surrogate family. He went along with all sorts of Hansons' weird shenanigans. Hanson married off one of his daughters to an English aristocrat who was manifestly insane. And the whole thing disintegrated. If I remember rightly, in the early 1820s, Byron had been called in as a witness to the marriage or something like that. The loyalty is rather moving. One would just say, get over it. Choose another legal advisor quickly.
You mentioned there Thomas More, the poet and author, who later became Lord Byron's biographer. They had a very close relationship. They really trusted each other. They really respected each other. They bounced creative ideas off each other. And, you know, the letters are beautiful to read. One of the things I was surprised to read later was that Thomas More burnt some of Byron's memoirs and diaries. You must find that very frustrating to know that all of these interesting sources that you could have read through were burned by such an amazing poet. In his own right, that he could do this, but presumably he was trying to protect him in some way, was he?
Yeah, I think of the people involved in that event, Moore is by far the least blamable. It is a shocking act of vandalism. It seems unthinkable to us. There is no reason on earth why Byron's memoirs of his marriage, because that's what these memoirs apparently principally involve, and his account of his marriage and its disintegration. There is no reason whatever, there was no reason why those papers could not have been carefully put under lock and key in a lawyer's office and some sort of arrangement entered into that they could only be reopened with the agreement of Byron's literary executors and so on and so forth. But what really appears to have been the truth is that there was some sort of typically proprietorial struggle amongst a group of men in the aftermath of Byron's death, which one of us holds Byron's interests most deeply to heart? Is it me, John Murray, the publisher? Is it me, John Cam Hobhouse, his greatest friend from university days? Is it me, Thomas Moore, his fellow poet? Do you follow me? Moore, indeed, many of the people involved with the burning of the memoirs hadn't even read them. John Murray hadn't read them, if I remember rightly. John Cam Hobhouse hadn't read them. Moore was one of the, I think, tiny group of people who actually had. And Byron had given them to him. And Moore had then, unfortunately, sold them as really as a sort of loan, to get a sort of loan from John Murray. He'd sold them to John Murray, so they were John Murray's property, but Moore wanted to try and get them back if he could buy them back. So Moore is less to blame than any other of those gentlemen around the grate in the office in Albemarle Street. But it is not an untypical thing, this. Byron is a magnetic personality, and it seems that everybody wants a slice of him, and the bigger the slice, the better. And so particularly someone like John Cam Hobhouse and Murray, wanting to prove that they know the poet better, wanting to prove that they have his interests most at heart, whereas you, Thomas Moore, are something of an interloper. You understand me. There are lots of mechanisms going on in that event. It's deeply sad and, to our eye, unforgivable and very hard to understand unless you see some of the forces at play behind what happened.
Richard, you have selected some terrific letters between Lady Byron, Annabella Milbank, and Lord Byron after their marriage had dissolved. I think it was between February and March 1816. And I might get you to read out some of them, because they're powerful letters. And what's clear is they had massive contempt for each other, but there was a lot of strong emotion in there as well, that they loved but and hated each other, you know, in equal amounts. And it kind of left me thinking as I was reading through those letters that possibly with that much rage, they possibly could have made a go of it. Because within that rage, there was such emotion, you know.
Yeah. The case is a deeply depressing one. And the entire case of the, I'll get to the letters in a minute if I may, the entire case is very difficult. It's terribly important to remember that it was, above all, a legal case and a legal separation.
She accused him of being insane, wasn't it, at the end, wasn't it? Or her father,
She, as anyone would in such a case, and the woman has a very difficult row to hoe in early 19th century England, seeking a legal separation from her husband. You can hardly blame her, let's be honest, for pressing every button and pulling every lever she possibly could and leaving innuendos and testimony around all over the place in order to get what she wanted, a separation and custody of her child, which ordinarily she would not get. So the whole position is very difficult to read through that kind of legal quagmire. But you're right, there are a couple of letters here from early February in 1816, when Byron had basically just been told they had parted in January, if I remember rightly, a month or so before, apparently in amity. I take it that Lady Byron got home to her mum and dad, began to talk to them a little bit, and they reacted in horror and said there is no way you can go back to this person and so on and so forth, and therefore legal proceedings started accordingly. Here he is writing to her on February 3rd, 1816. I have received a letter from your father proposing a separation between us, to which I cannot give an answer without being more acquainted with your own thoughts and wishes, and from yourself. To vague and general charges and exaggerated statements from others, I can give no reply. It is to you that I look, and with you that I can communicate on this subject. When I permit the interference of relatives, it will be as a courtesy to them and not the admission of a right. I feel naturally at a loss how to address you, ignorant as I am, how far the letter I have received has received your sanction. And in the circumstances into which this precipitation has forced me, whatever I might say would be liable to misconstruction. I'm really ignorant to what part of Sir Ralph's letter alludes, her father. Will you explain? To conclude, I shall eventually abide by your decision, but I request you most earnestly to weigh well the probable consequences and to pause before you pronounce. Whatever may occur, it is but justice to you to say that you are exempt from all fault whatever, and that neither now nor at any time have I the slightest imputation of any description to charge upon you. I cannot find myself other than yours most affectionately, Byron. And 2 days later or so, he tries, as it were, another tack. Dearest Belle, a nickname for her, name is Annabella. Dearest Belle, no answer from you yet. Perhaps it is as well. But do recollect that all is at stake, the present, the future, and even the colouring of the past. The whole of my errors, or what harsher name you choose to give them, you know. But I loved you, and will not part from you without your own most expressed refusal to return or receive me. He then goes on to quote a bit of Taming of the Shrew. Ever yours, dearest, most, Byron. So there are indeed, as you say, deep currents at play there. It's hard to see a person who wrote that second letter has no affection for the person to whom it's addressed. Yet, also from the outside, we would have to say this is an absolutely disastrous marriage. All one can say, I suppose, is for the love of Mike, don't marry someone in order to reform him or her, and don't marry someone in order to be reformed, which is what it would appear these unhappy pair of people, the kind of partnership they entered into. We can see a train wreck coming around the bend. But you're right, there are also marriage is a certain kind of commitment, and there are some deeper currents visible there in their correspondence, for sure.
He had two major continental chores of sort. He went from France to Spain to Albania, all through Italy. And then later he went on to defend and fight for Greek independence. I'm just wondering, how would you describe his political philosophy? Or did he have an actual solid one at all? Because he seems to be very mixed on a lot of political issues. And, you know, he spoke up for workers' rights. I know he spoke up about Catholic emancipation. But then he'd other very unusually conservative views, which didn't kind of tally up.
Yeah, I agree. His attitudes to politics are, I'm afraid, as mercurial as his attitudes to women. No question about it. I'm just reminded of the great American novelist Norman Mailer, who describes himself as a radical conservative, meaning not to say that he's a radical conservative. You know, he's both a radical and a conservative, and it's a paradox. And of Byron, one would have to say that he's like a conservative and a radical. The political position is totally unclear. Yes, a freedom fighter. For the Italians, of course, as well as the Greeks. On the other hand, also only ambivalently really bound up with workers' rights and reform in England. Reform was all very well in his view, but it must be supervised by people from his class. Radical democracy, radicalism, he really had very little time for at all, made fun of his friend John Cam Hobhouse, who became a radical MP. So, as I say, a mercurial set of attitudes, a different set of attitudes on the continent, where he could paint his politics to some degree with the brush of romance, a very different point of view from politics back at home. So, a complicated person, a Whig, an aristocratic Whig who went to a great Whig college at Trinity at Cambridge, but also in certain respects socially a conservative. So a living paradox always.
It struck me, Richard, as I was coming close to the end of your fine collection of letters, that In some ways, Byron felt constantly under pressure to produce another great poem. Obviously, when Childe Harold's Pilgrimage was published, he became an instant celebrity overnight. Everybody knew him. It was one of the most spoken poems of the time. And from then on in, he was constantly producing and writing, and he produced so much, but he always felt that weight on his shoulders. Do you think that could be argued that in one way success truly unsettled him and unnerved him in ways because he constantly had to live up to another great poem?
There are two sides to this. I think overnight success, everybody finds overnight success hard to cope with. I'm not sure there is a case on earth of anyone of being able to cope with it with ease. This was a man who was, in certain respects, extremely shy. He had come by his rank, for example, in highly unexpected circumstances. He lived the life of a middle-class, rather impoverished schoolboy in Aberdeen, and then all of a sudden is jet-setted to aristocracy, to the upper reaches of the aristocracy, just because somebody died in a military campaign somewhere. This is a person who's strikingly insecure, very shy, I think. Has a physical disability. So fame he found difficult to cope with. The writing matter is to some extent different. That is for him to make decisions about. People were forever prompting him to do this and that and the other, to write a great epic, to write this. And he was always telling them basically to get out of his way. What I think is amazing about him is this prodigious originality. If Childe Harold's Pilgrimage is not the greatest long poem in English of the Romantic period, then Don Juan certainly is, given that Wordsworth's The Prelude was not published and unheard of or unknown until 1850. These are the two great long poems of the English Romantic era, enormously influential. His friends would have told him, of course, not to publish Don Juan, not to continue with it. That only made him continue with it more eagerly. I would want to say, I mean, one of the things I keep ponder hours thinking to myself is what I ought to do is write a book on Byron's poetic masterpieces, because there are so many of them. It is not just Childe Harold and Don Juan, of which people may have heard. There are so many other great poems, The Giaour, The Prisoner of Chillon, Beppo, Mazeppa, some fascinating neoclassical plays. The originality really is prodigious, and I think these are marks that Byron mostly is setting for himself, and it's lucky in a way that he was in Italy, in a foreign culture, where he could set his own marks and decide himself what he wanted to do and where he wanted to take his talent.
Last question for you. Will there be another Byron?
Yeah. How can I answer this question? The modern age has had many vital and striking and positive developments in it. Everybody knows this. Medicine, technology, education, democracy, etc., etc., etc. Yet it's also true, I think, that we look back to some extent to the 19th century and look at the people of that era. And they seem not just in poetry, not just in the arts, but in other areas of human adventure too. And they seem gigantic to us by comparison. It's the era of Dickens and Balzac and Verdi and Wagner and Delacroix and Turner, and but also of George Eliot and Jane Austen and so on. And Tolstoy and people of this kind, we look back with a certain kind of anxiety, I think, to people of that era, and wonder if we ever can replicate them in the culture that we possess. I'm not sure we want to swap contemporary culture and go back to the 19th century with all its terrible injustices and cruelties and inhumanities. But part of us also, I think, recognizes, are we likely to produce another Byron in the world that we inhabit now? I can't say I see any signs of one, but you never can tell.
And that was literary scholar, writer and teacher Richard Lansdowne. Byron's Letters and Journals, a new selection, is published by Oxford University Press and retails for in around €17 in paperback. Now, I have to say hats off to Richard. This is a stunning collection of letters. They're lively, vivid and wonderfully unique. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. OK, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Simon Maguire, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to close tonight's broadcast with the reflective and candid words of Lord Byron, taken from a letter to Percy Bysshe Shelley, dated April 26, 1821, just 3 years short of Byron's death. "You want me to undertake a great poem? I have not the inclination nor the power. As I grow older, the indifference not to life, for we love it by instinct, but to the stimuli of life increases. Besides, this late failure of the Italians has disappointed me for many reasons, some public, some personal. My respects to Mrs. S. Yours ever, B. Good night."
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.